Culture, Politics, and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week we have two authors talking about their books, their new books. I'm very happy to welcome Luke Harding back to the show to talk about collusion, secret meetings, dirty money, and how Russia helped Donald Trump win. It's an important book. Luke's a journalist with The Guardian and was its Moscow bureau chief for 4 years. And I should just note that we recorded the interview on Thursday, the day before Michael Flynn pled guilty to a charge of lying to the FBI. And we learned that he's going to sing like a canary. So I would have loved to have talked about that a little bit, but happened the day after we recorded. So then we're going to be joined by Gary Rivlin. He's the co-author with Michael Hudson of a short new book titled Wall Street's White House, How Gary Cohn Wrecked the Global Economy and Parlayed It into a White House Job. We recorded that one just hours before Senate Republicans passed a disastrous tax bill in the middle of the night. So we're slightly behind the news cycle this week with both of our authors. I mean, it is what it is. It's a weekly show. These are books. They're both important in understanding the current moment. So you'll have to catch your news somewhere else. Go to MSNBC for the breaking stuff. And because we have so much ground to cover, I'm going to skip the usual snarky news roundup, and we're going to jump right in. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back with Luke Harding. Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. I'm joined now by Luke Harding. Luke's a reporter for The Guardian. He served as its Moscow bureau chief from 2007 until he was booted out of the country in 2011. He's the author of an important new book titled Collusion, Secret Meetings, Dirty Money, and How Russia Helped Trump Win. Luke, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Michelle Goldberg wrote in the New York Times that the problem with the Trump-Russia story is not a lack of evidence so much as the evidence of something, and we're not sure of the exact contours of that something, is overwhelming and hard to parse. And I have to say that there were some things in the book that I didn't know, but for the most part, I was surprised by how many of these stories I'd forgotten because, you know, it's just one thing after another for over a year, and it's hard to keep it all track all together in your head. And I think the book is so powerful because it puts a couple of years of reporting together in kind of one coherent narrative. I often see skeptics of the Russia story taking one part of the larger whole and kind of mocking it. They'll say, for example, you know, $100,000 worth of Facebook ads are unlikely to have any impact on the election. And of course, the nature of covert action is to be covert, so we don't really know the precise extent or scope of Russia's active measures campaign in 2016. But can you give us a sense of the scope based on what we do know?
Yes. Well, I mean, I think one of the things I tried to do in this book is that people are very familiar with the American heroes, anti-heroes, if you like, whether it's Paul Manafort or Carter Page or Donald Trump Jr., God bless him. But they're kind of less au fait with the Russians. And really, I think what we're talking about here is allegedly a kind of conspiracy with two halves. And the American half is kind of well documented. But what I wanted to try and illuminate was what the Russians were doing, and also to be contextual, to explain that if you really want to interpret what happened, whether you're a skeptic or not a skeptic, last year in America, you need to go backwards, almost through a kind of wormhole towards Cold War times. And you need to be a sort of student of espionage, and in particular, the KGB method. And so what I wanted to do was to kind of marry some of the contemporaneous stuff that we've seen in the news with my own reporting from Moscow, the fact that I feel I understand Russian spydom, having suffered from it to an extent, you know, when I was the kind of bureau chief there for The Guardian, for my newspaper, and my flat was broken into and I was bugged and followed around and all the rest of it, but also to look at how the KGB used to do things, because actually, to understand, you need to understand Putin and his methods. And Putin operates in the manner of a classic KGB-trained spy. Covertly, he lies about things, almost as a kind of operational tactic. And he uses strategies of subterranean influence that were tried and tested during the 60s and 70s under Leonid Brezhnev and so on. And so I wanted to kind of pull that together and at the same time write a kind of a nonfiction story in the manner of John le Carré, but one that was importantly and crucially all true.
Yeah, I don't want to kiss your butt too much, but I have to say that the piece reads like a thriller. Sometimes reporters are not great at prose, and it's really a page-turner. But again, how big is this? We don't know exactly, but do you have a sense of the contours here?
I think it's enormous, but I also think that we have to be clear that Putin is not Superman. I mean, he's not sitting in or some kind of evil villain in a cave flicking red switches. I mean, he's essentially an opportunist and someone who very adroitly has taken advantage of problems in the West, divisions in American society, whether they're cultural or racial or sort of political, and he sought to exploit and instrumentalize them for his own purposes. But I mean, I think this is a huge story. I think it's, without wanting to come across as hyperbolic, I think it's bigger than Watergate, because this isn't one set of Americans doing dirty tricks to another set of Americans as it was back in the 70s. This is one set of Americans basically dialing in or dialing out to a kind of powerful foreign power to help it sort of cripple an opponent, in this case, kind of Hillary Clinton. So the stakes are much larger. And I think Putin has kind of done this sort of very cleverly. And there are also kind of really interesting questions about Russia's relationship with Donald Trump, how far it goes back. And one thing my book makes clear, or seeks to make clear, is that the Soviets and the Russians play a very long game, and they've been interested in Donald Trump for a very long time.
I think it's really important to make that point that Putin is not a superhuman person. There have been some concerns among Russian reformers that the way that we portray this story really helps Vladimir Putin's image as this kind of mastermind world manipulator. In some ways, he lucked out, and a lot of these methods were kind of low rent. I mean, when you talk about sending out phishing emails, that's not the most sophisticated form of hacking that there is. Let me ask you this, Luke. You'd write about, and I want to stay on hackers for a moment. You write about hackers, and you say that there's this kind of fuzzy line between the Russian government and these shady groups of quasi-criminal hackers. There is a need to, on the Russian side, to maintain plausible deniability, right? I mean, how is that relationship work? Have we teased that out?
Well, I mean, and I kind of rely to a degree on some very good kind of Russian reporting here, in particular on Andrei Soldatov, who's written a kind of fantastic book called The Red Web. Andrei kind of, I sort of discussed this extensively with him when I was kind of writing my hacking chapter, but essentially there are hackers who are kind of criminal, that they do the stuff for money, and they quite often they get co-opted by the FSB, which is the spy agency, and they have to do these things which are essentially the state is pulling the strings, but as you say, they're kind of deniable and say that they will hack this material, and someone will make a strategic decision how and when to release it. There are cutouts. In this case, of course, famously WikiLeaks, which published emails, published John Podesta's emails at a time designed a bit like a kind of bomb to cause maximum damage to Hillary Clinton. But the thing is, if you think about the kind of Russian state, it's not like the American government or let's say the sort of German government. I wrote a previous book called Mafia State. There is a bureaucracy superficially it looks like a kind of a government with a parliament and with elections and so on, but actually that's largely kind of decorative. But the point is that the government has a very close relationship with organized crime, and in itself is kind of criminal in nature, where there are two projects going on at the moment in contemporary Russia. One of them is this sort of revisionist influence project to nationalist project to project Russian power and to assert what Moscow would sort of say is kind of is bipolarity. In other words, a world in which Russia is the equal of America, even though it isn't. But the other project is to steal stuff. And by stuff, I mean kind of billions of dollars from state enterprises, things like Gazprom, things like Rosneft, the oil producer, and the people who sit at the top of these organizations are some of the richest people on the planet. So criminality is kind of hardwired into the system, but that doesn't mean that the state can't do patriotic things like hacking the American election.
It's a blurry line. You know, we have this kind of very clear delineation. It's not always that clear, but a relatively clear delineation between public and private spheres, between the state and, say, the business community. Of course, we have revolving doors, et cetera, et cetera. But in Russia, it's so much fuzzier. And time again in the book, you point out that this person that met with that person in the Trump circle has these tentacles that intertwine with the Russian state, with the Kremlin, with Vladimir Putin. There's a temptation when one sees all these stories of Trump's inner circle meeting with Russian intelligence operatives and these cutouts for the Kremlin, and you see how long they've been kind of, I don't know if grooming him is the right word, but there's a temptation to see Trump as some kind of Manchurian candidate. You write that in reality, the relationship was likely much more transactional than that. Can you unpack that?
I think we need to kind of talk a little bit about the dossier by Christopher Steele, the former British intelligence agent.
I'm about to get to that.
Transactional. I think it is transactional. What you can say is that Donald Trump is the kind of leader that Vladimir Putin likes to deal with. He doesn't like people who are idealists. He doesn't believe in international law. He thinks that he doesn't actually really believe that Western democracies are democracies. He thinks that they're basically shinier versions of Russia, essentially kind of hypocritical. And so he hates being lectured, for example, by visiting Western leaders on human rights. He likes leaders in the mold of Silvio Berlusconi in Italy or Gerhard Schröder in Germany, or par excellence Donald Trump, where you don't talk about abstract ideas or kind of noble ends or civic values. You talk about deals, you know, deals, and preferably ones done over energy, sort of bilateral deals, which are to Russia's advantage, and maybe with a little sweetener on the side for your nephew or whoever. That's the kind of world that Vladimir Putin operates in, and he genuinely thinks that practically anything can be negotiated, and if it can't be negotiated, it's a conspiracy. And therefore, Donald Trump is a perfect interlocutor. And what we know from publicly available evidence is whenever they meet, they seem to get on terrifically. Trump seems to be more attracted to Putin, almost this kind of magnetism going on, or a kind of a strange allure, more attracted to Putin than any other leader. Now, why is that?
It is bizarre. Other Russian experts I've spoken with say that Putin sees the kind of post-World War II international order, the UN, the human rights courts, even as far as the Paris Accord, he sees all of these things as kind of tools of Western hegemony, and he's not entirely wrong about that. I mean, I think that you can make a serious case that that's true, but they have served, I think, the greater good to a greater degree than they have been a hindrance. Let's turn to the Steele dossier. It plays a huge role in this story. It's a big part of your book. Michael Steele was a very serious former spook. How long was he in British intelligence?
Well, he had 22 years in British intelligence.
22 years.
He was well regarded,
very well regarded in the intelligence community. You write that he's a conservative analyst who isn't prone to including, rumors in his reports. And the dossier really sent shockwaves through the intelligence community. But it was raw intelligence, and Steele himself thought that, you know, some of it might turn out to be wrong. Many of the things that Steele reported have since been verified by others, including yourself. But the most salacious bits, the golden showers, the prostitutes, have not. Let me ask you this. To what degree do you think BuzzFeed's decision to publish the dossier in its entirety shaped the way it was received or the way that the media covered it?
Well, I mean, it was a bold decision by BuzzFeed. I think it was the right decision to publish all of it, because the point was that this dossier or highlights or some of the kind of allegations were swirling around, and a lot of journalists, I would say from kind of late fall of 2016, were aware of it. I didn't actually see it until BuzzFeed published, although I did get an email summarizing or praising some of it. And the point was that it was having an impact on the political conversation. I mean, the Harry Reid, famously, the sort of senior Democrat, wrote to Jim Comey after getting a briefing on this stuff in late August, saying you are sitting on explosive information containing Donald Trump, and yet you haven't seen fit to kind of inform the American public. And so the thing was, when everyone on sort of Capitol Hill, everyone in Washington knows about these rumors, but actually ordinary Americans don't. I think BuzzFeed did the right thing by publishing. And as you say, Christopher Steele is not saying this dossier is 100% correct. He acknowledges that some of it may be wrong, but his assessment, as sort of told to me by his friends, is that it's somewhere between 70 and 90% right. In other words, it's mostly right. And what he did was that the plan A, if you like, wasn't to get BuzzFeed to publish it. In fact, I think that Chris was less than thrilled by the fact that BuzzFeed did publish it. That plan A was to get the FBI to go full out to investigate and use all of its resources to prove or disprove it. And I think what happened was kind of he sent his memos to the FBI, and he was increasingly disillusioned by their almost kind of nonchalant response or lack of response. They just really didn't seem to be doing very much. And the final straw for him was when Comey announced that he was reopening the investigation into Hillary's emails 10 days before Election Day, while still keeping silent about Trump and the far more incendiary claims that he was essentially in bed with Russia. So I think Steele did the right thing. Then the dossier was published, and the rest we know.
This piece of the book, I have to tell you, made my blood boil, because it's just extremely clear that members of the U.S. intelligence community at the highest levels were looking very, very seriously at this dossier for a significant period of time and then let the ball drop. And at the same time, they did
more than that. I mean, they misbriefed the New York Times at one point and said there was nothing in it. And that almost, to me, is the most astonishing aspect. Not just that they didn't put the foot on the accelerator, they kind of coasted along, but that there was some kind of disinformation going on as well.
And they said specifically that the reason that they were hesitant to pursue this as a public matter, to go public with it, was because they didn't want to intervene in the U.S. election. And then Comey makes this announcement, and it was like the Seinfeld of announcements, right? There was actually nothing, that he was reopening the case into Hillary Clinton's emails, which was a story that I never even understood the significance of. It is a maddening piece of the story. It really is. Folks, this is Joshua Holland. I'm speaking with Luke Harding from The Guardian about his new book, Collusion. You were already looking at the story before you met with Steele and before you had gotten a look at the memos published by BuzzFeed. And he kind of steered you in the right direction. He said, or in a direction, he said, follow the money. And this is a central piece of this story of what we know. In broad terms, because this is like half of your book, what happens when you follow the money?
Well, what happens is that it gets complicated very, very, very quickly, and it's very hard to kind of be definitive. And in a way, a lot of the evidence around Donald Trump and money is circumstantial. I mean, there is a kind of factual scaffold, if you like. We know that Russians have been buying properties in Trump Tower. Not since last week, but since Trump Tower went up in the 1980s, some of these Russians were mafia people who did time subsequently for kind of felonies. This is a kind of recurring motif through the story of Russians, often criminal connected Russians, investing in kind of Trump property. But there are other elements to it as well. I mean, one is the thing that we were talking to Steele about the fact that this Russian oligarch, Dmitry Rybolovlev, very wealthy man, kind of multi-billionaire, bought Trump's Florida house in 2008 for $95 million, and leaving Trump, who bought the same property a couple of years earlier, with a $50 million profit. And I spent time with Rybolovlev's press guy, who says that the oligarch put on a pair of swimming trunks and did paddle past the property, but he never actually set foot in it. And bought it, discovered it had mold, demolished it, and is now reselling it in chunks. Now, I mean, this is someone who's very good with money, who made a fortune in the post-Soviet Union, and yet he effectively gifts Trump $50 million. Now, why would he do that? I mean, he says, nothing to see here. Okay, that's fair enough. And meanwhile, there's another very curious story, which is a chapter in my book, which is Deutsche Bank, Germany's biggest lender, a bank with global pretensions, that lent huge sums of money to Donald Trump. Same year, 2008, Trump defaulted on a major loan, $45 million, sued the bank. And then for reasons which are still inexplicable, the bank continued to lend to him. He still owes Deutsche Bank about $300 million. And just lastly, while Deutsche Bank is doing this out of its New York division, the same German bank in Russia is running essentially a kind of VIP money laundering scam where $10 billion from Moscow is sent out of the country, and this whole thing kind of explodes, and the bank is massively fined. I think when it comes to the money, I think we have maybe 10-15% of the story, and I think 85% of that story is still submerged.
Yeah, and we haven't even gotten to the casinos, which are such a prime source of money laundering traditionally, and I think that's clearly going to be a big piece of this when all is said and done. I think everything, well, I don't know if everything will come out, but I think we're going to learn a lot more before everything is said and done. As you know, I write for The Nation. There's a fair degree of skepticism about the Russia story among some of my colleagues. Let me ask you a few questions about that.
Sure.
There are some, like Stephen Cohen, whose views are long held and were shaped by their scholarship or their experiences with Russia. But there's a much larger group of skeptics on the left who are pretty transparently influenced by the idea that blaming Russia or apportioning some blame to Russia for Trump's election absolves Hillary Clinton from running a bad campaign or not focusing enough on her economic message or whatever. You can find plenty of people like me who supported Bernie Sanders in the primaries but take Russia's intervention seriously. But I can't think of a single skeptic who wasn't strongly opposed to her candidacy. Now, this combination of Russian disinformation, online trolling, cyber warfare, the things that you describe as kind of standard operating procedure are not unique to our elections. It's seen as an issue across Europe. I'm wondering how the conversation differs in your neck of the woods in countries where people weren't invested in this kind of divisive primary. Like, do you see a lot of similar skepticism over allegations of Russian interference in France or Germany or Brexit or in the former Soviet bloc?
It's an interesting question. I mean, I would just say, just to clarify, my position is relatively straightforward. It's quite possible that Hillary ran a terrible campaign.
Yes.
And that Russia interfered.
Me too. That's my position.
Mutually exclusive. And that's essentially what I think. I mean, I don't think she was a great candidate, but I'm not an American, and it's for you guys to kind of figure all that out. But I've got no doubt that Russia did interfere, and I think more successfully. But you say my neighborhood. Well, I think in Europe, actually, we kind of got the memo some years ago, and I'm speaking to you from London. And London, of course, is the sort of capital where in 2006, two Kremlin assassins sent by Vladimir Putin, we can say this now because there's been a kind of public inquiry here, poisoned a guy called Alexander Litvinenko, who's a Russian dissident, an ex-FSB officer, with a radioactive cup of tea in really one of the most dramatic and astonishing murders since the Cold War. And this is a huge case here. It was front page news. There was a massive criminal inquiry by Scotland Yard, the police force in London, and thousands of pages of scientific evidence. And basically a retired judge concluded that this was a Kremlin plot. In other words, a decade before the US election hack, the Russia of Vladimir Putin felt sufficiently emboldened to bump off people the president personally didn't like on the streets of a European capital. And so I think here there's much more skepticism towards Russia. There's a absolute kind of belief that Russia does do aggressive stuff internationally. We've seen the war in Ukraine, the annexation of Crimea. We've seen Europe's borders changed by force for the first time since 1945. And so I think there's much less skepticism here, regardless of whether Hillary was a good candidate or not, about what Russia does. And the nearer you get to the Russian Federation border, I mean, talk to the Baltic countries of Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, that they are fearful. They are worried. That they are fretting about who or what is going to be next after the United States.
Luke, I've gone over our time. Do you have two or three more minutes?
Sure.
You write at some point you got a pitch from someone in Clinton's inner circle for a story. You had already had that story, and you didn't really follow up. Another thing that skeptics on the left and the right in this country claim frequently is that this whole story has been driven by the kind of obsession of Democratic partisans. What do you make of that claim from your perspective as a journalist who's worked on this story?
I find it slightly bizarre, and in a way, I wasn't writing a book about kind of, you know, domestic European politics. I was writing a book about Russia and Donald Trump, very much in that order. But I would just, I respect other people's views. I think, given the cacophonous times we live in, it's important to be kind of polite towards other ideas and to accept that things are kind of complicated. But a lot of the people who are very skeptical about this narrative actually know nothing whatsoever about Russia. So far as I can tell, they've not really been there, or if they have been there, they've been as tourists. They don't speak Russian. They don't read the Russian press. They are not familiar with KGB espionage. And therefore, by all means, that they can be as vehement as they like about what's happening domestically inside the United States. But But I think when it comes to Russia, that they could perhaps be a little humbler than they sometimes are.
Let me just add my two cents onto that. As far as the idea that the Democratic Party is driving this story, it seems to me that that investigative journalists like yourself, Michael Steele with his dossier, which was first funded by conservative opponents of Trump in the primaries before Democrats did kind of take that over, has been driving the story. It's been reporters' shoe leather that has kept this story in the news, and Trump's own actions, because, you know, this story got new legs when Trump fired the FBI director and went on television to say, "I did it because of the Trump-Russia investigation." The story got new legs when he told several Russian diplomats that he had fired Comey in order to stop the Russian investigation. It is Donald Trump who is obsessed with this story and who keeps it alive by constantly tweeting about it, constantly talking about it, et cetera, et cetera. So if you were to ask me who is driving the story, I would say investigative reporters, the intelligence agencies, and Donald Trump himself, first and foremost. One other common claim among Russian skeptics is that the story is being promoted by unreformed cold warriors in the U.S. And you write that Vladimir Putin, this former head of the KGB, is quite open in his nostalgia for the old Soviet Union. One of your chapter heads is a quote from Putin saying that the dissolution of the Soviet Union, and I'm paraphrasing, I don't have it in front of me, was like the greatest tragedy of the 20th century. There a certain irony of blaming U.S. intelligence officials for being stuck in a Cold War mentality when Putin's so open about his own Cold War wistfulness? I mean, he wants to make Russia great again.
I mean, you can call it irony, but let's be clear. This is not a kind of neocon position. I'm a journalist. I describe reality first and foremost, but I guess my civic position is progressive. I would describe myself as of the left, and that means I care about things like human rights and what you might call universal values, if that doesn't seem too old-fashioned. And if you look at the domestic situation in Russia, there are no free elections. The press and TV is pretty much under the Kremlin's thumb. Dissidents, people who stick out or kind of annoy the regime, suffer consequences ranging from minor to being shot dead outside the Kremlin. And so I think we need to be kind of mindful of that. But just in terms of the kind of Cold War question, I don't think Putin makes much secret about it. I mean, really, his sort of sensibility, his sort of geopolitical sensibility is shaped by the Cold War. He regards the fact that Russia lost it, or the Soviet Union lost it, in inverted commas, as a profound humiliation. And what he's now seeking to do is to win the next Cold War, Cold War II, if you like. And it's being fought again. It's being fought in a way that pays no heed to kind of international law, whether it's starting war in Ukraine, assassinating a dissident in London, or hacking an American election. He thinks the West is weak. He thinks the West is decadent. He thinks the West is hypocritical. Even though Russia is not a powerful country, it is exploiting traditional patterns and methods of KGB espionage to the utmost. Sometimes it works well, sometimes not so well. But he is a Cold War warrior, but he's a kind of Cold War II warrior in the age of Facebook and Twitter. And that's all there is to it, really.
Folks, whatever you think of the Russia situation, Luke's book is called Collusion, Secret Meetings, Dirty Money, and How Russia Helped Trump Win. It's an important book. You should give it a read. Luke Harding, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you, Josh. I really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back.
There's a place place where lovers go to cry their troubles away, and they call it Lonesome Town, where the broken hearts stay. You can buy a dream or two to last you all through the years, and the only price you pay is a heart full of tears. Going down to Lonesome Town, where the broken hearts stay. Going down to Lonesome Town to cry my troubles away. In the town of broken dreams, the streets are filled with regret. Maybe down in Lonesome Town I can learn to forget. Maybe down in Lonesome Town I can learn to forget.
Welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm still Joshua Holland. A lot of people think politicians say whatever they need to say to get elected, and then they do what they want once they get into office. There's actually a fairly robust political science literature that suggests that's not the case. Presidents don't always succeed in keeping their campaign promises, but they almost always try. Until Trump. The Trump regime is an outlier in that sense. And now we should give him credit. He has tried to keep his promises on the, the racism and xenophobia front. He's done a good job with that. But never has a candidate reversed himself on economic policy as dramatically as this guy has after taking power. He promised affordable health care for everyone and since has been trying to strip it from millions of people. He railed against the Republican establishment and then made the head of the RNC his chief of staff. He promised to drain the swamp and then surrounded himself with lobbyists and has consistently enriched himself using the power of his office. My next guest has co-authored a short book on what may well be Trump's greatest betrayal of his promises to those white working class voters that we hear so much about. Gary Rivlin is the author with Michael Hudson of Wall Street's White House, How Gary Cohn Wrecked the Global Economy and Parlayed It into a White House Job. Gary, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Great to be with you.
Thanks so much for taking the time. So on the campaign trail, Donald Trump not only attacked Hillary Clinton for giving speeches to Goldman, but also hit Ted Cruz because his wife worked at the banking giants. He gets into office and he appoints Cohn, who he had met during the campaign when Cohn was president of Goldman Sachs, to be his senior economic advisor. But he's not the only Goldman alum in the Trump White House, right?
Right. So you had Steve Bannon, who had spent 5 years earlier in his career at Goldman. But more than that, his Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin, who's right there at the center with Gary Cohn of the tax debate. His father worked at Goldman Sachs, was actually a top executive at Goldman Sachs. He and his brother worked for years, became partners at Goldman Sachs. Gary Cohn, who actually met Trump after the election, it was a few weeks after the election. Gary Cohn, weirdly, is a registered Democrat. I mean, I would argue he's selling his soul for tax cuts and other benefits for Goldman right. Sachs and himself. But, you know, he is technically a registered Democrat and had nothing to do with Trump during the campaign. But he helped bring in Dina Powell, who's the number two in national security. She worked for years at Goldman Sachs. You have Jay Clayton, the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission. He never worked for Goldman Sachs, but he was one of Goldman Sachs's top lawyers with Sullivan and Cromwell, and he's married to a
VP from Goldman Sachs. And, you know, then you have Anthony Scaramucci, who, you know, what do you have, 10 days or 11 days? I've heard it both ways.
The mooch.
You know, he too worked at Goldman Sachs. So at one point you had, you know, five, if not six, if you're going to include Jay Clayton at SEC.
What was Elizabeth Warren's great quote about that?
Yeah, they're going to have they're opening a new branch. Goldman Sachs is opening a new branch in the White House. And yeah, I mean, you put your finger on it. It's just like, I mean, here's someone who came in and campaigned against Wall Street and money manipulation and, you know, the siphoning off of billions of dollars from the working class, black, white, Latino. Doesn't make a difference. And, you know, what was that about? That was the reaction to the subprime meltdown, the 2008 disaster. Left and right, there's anger at Wall Street over the Wall Street manipulations, their shenanigans, their breaking of rules. And not only does he name a big banker from Goldman Sachs, of all places, as his top economic advisor, Gary Cohn was one of the real villains of subprime. He was the one overseeing the mortgage desk for Goldman Sachs in the early 2000s and got them aggressively into the subprime field. Tens of billions of dollars of subprime loans, investing in AmeriQuest, New Century, the big subprime lenders, giving them lines of credit, and also they played a really bad role in the front end. And then, you know, to their credit, Goldman Sachs at the end of 2006, very early, saw that this was going to end in disaster, and they made what they themselves called the big short, now a famous term, but basically betting against the market. Gary Cohn was the number two, the president of Goldman Sachs at the time, and, you know, their plot was to let's short the market, let's make all these complicated bets to that the market falls. Meanwhile, we've got billions of dollars of these subprime loans on our books. We know they're going to blow up. They're toxic. We don't want to own them. And they could have gone to their clients. That's what investment bankers do. They advise clients. They could have said, you know, we've been selling you these things and not turning out very well. Let's figure out how to unwind you from that. But no, that wouldn't be very good for Goldman Sachs's bottom line. So instead, what they do is secretly for months, 7-8 months, we're selling to their very clients these packages of mortgages that they knew were going to blow up. They knew were going to default. And, you know, they would end up paying $9 billion in fines, or almost $9 billion in fines to the federal government for misdeeds leading up to the subprime meltdown. But, you know, meanwhile, the year of the big short, Gary Cohn was paid $73 million by Goldman Sachs. And, you know, 1 year, 2008, he had to get by on $600,000 a year. But pretty much every year since then, he's been getting $20 million a year, give or take a million or two. And, you know, here's somebody whose fingerprints were all over the subprime meltdown. He benefits financially from it. And, you know, lo and behold, he's got this office in the White House and is right there at the president's side, despite the president running against the exact kind of crimes that Gary Cohn is in part responsible for.
It's incredible. And so I just want people to understand, the big short was when Goldman was shorting. They were betting against their own clients, right? That's the thing that people really need to understand, how cutthroat this institution is. So there's this stark hypocrisy in that he was a caricature, like a cartoon villain in the subprime mortgage crisis. But there's another aspect to this as well, because remember, Trump said that he'd protect the little guy from the globalists and the hedge fund guys who had screwed them over. And he really talked a lot about American jobs, America first, et cetera, et cetera. So the other part of this is that if you could kind of call up central casting and say, give me a globalist who's into offshoring jobs, who would you get?
Gary Cohn. No, you know, there was a speech that was given right around the election where Cohn is down in Florida and boasting about how smart they are to, you know, offshore all these like accountant jobs, like the internal jobs, the cost controls and stuff to India. And he explained it, you know, they're on the record there for, you know, they could pay them pennies on the dollar. You know, I mean, here at Goldman Sachs, one of their specialties were these tax inversions, where an American company buys a much smaller overseas company, preferably in a place like Ireland, where their corporate taxes are really low. And, you know, lo and behold, you know, they move their corporate headquarters to that overseas country. So Trump, the candidate, was railing against this, as well he should have, because, you know, Pfizer was the big example, but, you know, there are others. Well, Goldman Sachs, this is one of their specialties. And, you know, so we had an example of, you know, one of these tax inversions. So that they did a year or two before. Mergers and acquisitions. We found some report. There's an activist group that found something like $22,000 lost jobs because of mergers and acquisitions that Goldman Sachs had done in the previous half dozen or so years under Gary Cohn. So yeah, you put it very well. If like, I was looking for exactly the kind of person that Donald Trump would campaign against, it might have been Gary Cohn. He chose Lloyd Blankfein, who happened to be Gary Cohn's boss, the number one, the CEO of Goldman Sachs, who literally is in an ad they ran in the closing days of the campaign, blaming the globalists like Lloyd Blankfein. But instead of hiring Lloyd Blankfein, who I don't think would have went to work for the Trump administration, he got the second best as number two.
This is unbelievable. So, all right. You write that it's not clear whether Cohn.
Wait, I just have to say, I can't believe I'm leaving out one of the. I left out one of the Goldman Sachs people, Steve Mnuchin, right? I mean, Treasury.
I think you mentioned him.
No, but the top two economic advisors to the president, the head of the Treasury, and Gary Cohn, his two top economic advisors are Goldman Sachs. I mean, it's not even like one of those things like, okay, you know, I mean, Obama did this. Let's have our Larry Summers, our old hands who have dirty fingerprints from disasters in the 90s, and pair them with other people who might have a more progressive view. I mean, this is just simply, let me run against Goldman Sachs, I get into office, and make my top two people on economic issues. And we see what's happening with the tax plan. I mean, one more incredible.
I'm going to ask you about the tax plan in a minute. Before I get there, though, you write that it's not clear whether Cohn continues to have tangible conflicts of interest with his former employer. There are questions about his disclosures, et cetera, et cetera. But really, it doesn't matter because when you're Treasury Secretary, when you're the national, what is the head of the president's economic advisory council... Right.
Yeah, he's the director of the National Economic Council.
Director of the National Economic Council, or when you're a Treasury Secretary, as Gary Mnuchin is, everything they do is going to impact Global Sachs, right?
Well, I mean, that's the fig leaf of recusing yourself. Like, pretty much the Trump agenda is the Goldman Sachs agenda. Let's push for financial deregulation. Well, lo and behold, you see that Gary Cohn, when he was president of Goldman Sachs, their huge lobbying arm, they've got like 50 lobbyists, literally, they're spending $4 or $5 million a year. What are their priorities? Financial deregulation, cutting corporate taxes. Let's ease the rules on IPOs because we, Goldman Sachs, are one of the top two or three firms in the IPO field. Let's privatize infrastructure. Sure, a $1 trillion infrastructure plan, but let's privatize it. Guess what? Goldman Sachs is one of the top four or five companies in the public financing of infrastructure, private financing of infrastructure. And so you go down the line and you see the Trump agenda and the Goldman agenda are one and the same.
And it was Cohn who sold Trump on the idea of this kind of privatizing infrastructure package. And that was something, if you go back to very early in this White House, there are people who said, well, maybe Trump can pick off Democrats by passing a big infrastructure package. And it was the nature of the infrastructure package that it would just sell off swaths of the public sector that made it impossible for Democrats to work with him. So there's a real irony there, and it goes back to the beginning of this whole nightmarish year of under Trump. Now, if you're just tuning in, I'm Joshua Holland. I'm speaking with Gary Rivlin about his new book, Wall Street's White House. Trump likes to pretend that he's a self-made man and a tough guy. These things are not true of Trump, but you write that in some ways, Cohn really is the guy that Trump likes to think of himself as being. Can you just speak to that briefly? Because I want to get on to a couple of other things.
Right, sure. So Gary Cohn, born outside of Cleveland, I would call him middle class, but born dyslexic at long before we knew how to deal with that, had been in four or five elementary schools. Donald Trump claims, and even he says he was overstating it, that he punched a teacher when he was in second grade or something like that. Well, actually, Gary Cohn did punch a teacher when he was fourth or fifth grade. And you sort of understand it in a human way. Weirdly, Malcolm Gladwell had this book, you know, Goliath, David and Goliath, and there's Gary Cohn's story, and you really feel for this guy who, you know, everyone just thinks he's stupid or not trying. He's hardly stupid, and he works harder than seems anyone. And, you know, just through sheer determination, his mother and father had been told, oh, if he's a truck driver, you'll be happy. You know, he becomes an aluminum siding salesman, talks his way into a job selling derivatives, selling commodities. And, you know, within 5 years or so, is it Goldman Sachs, you know, loyal guy, the kind of guy who will run through walls for you, sees an opportunity in subprime mortgages in the early 2000s, and who cares if we wreck the global economy? We're going to get rich doing it. And, you know, so here's that guy, and, you know, he's now worth $300-400 million and has an office in the White House, had been thrown around as one of the finalists for the Fed chair. So the arc of his story really is amazing. And there is some kind of sympathy. I just think he made a devil's bargain. I really just see it as that, you know, Trump as the Trojan horse, Trump as the vessel that Gary Cohn could travel for financial deregulation, for slashing taxes. You look at the, you know, the corporate taxes, you know, a 20% cut would save Goldman Sachs about $1 billion a year. Some of the financial deregulation they're talking about would earn Goldman Sachs billions of dollars every year, Goldman Sachs and other banks. So, you know, it just seems to me that he just, you know, just accept Trump for what Trump is, so long as we could get the tax cuts, the privatizing of infrastructure, and kind of get the Goldman agenda passed.
And then Cohn lent Trump a certain amount of legitimacy with Wall Street. I mean, Goldman, as you write in the book, Goldman wouldn't do business with Trump because he was a sleazebag, and you know, went bankrupt over and over again. Nobody took Trump seriously as a business guy in New York City, as a real business guy. None of the serious players took him seriously. So by bringing in Cohn, you know, he was this erratic, you know, loudmouth. Big Wall Street execs said, okay, maybe this administration will be good for us. Now, I want to ask you about a couple of items in the news this week. First, we saw this kind of mini coup d'etat at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Trump appointed his OMB director, Mick Mulvaney, to be the agency's interim head. The Dodd-Frank law that created it actually gave that power to the outgoing director, in this case, Richard Cordray. Cordray had picked his deputy for the job. And then a judge that was appointed by Trump just 2 months ago rejected her lawsuit to block Mulvaney. And he said he was going to freeze and then start unraveling the agency's consumer protections, right? Mulvaney, by the way, has trashed the CFPB again and again and again. He's like staunchly anti-regulation. But it was really Cohn who came up with the regime's wish list for financial regulation, deregulation, much earlier, right?
Yeah, so I mean, one thing that's interesting, the Treasury Secretary sounds the more important, certainly more prestigious position, but, you know, Mnuchin had to go through confirmation. Gary Cohn showed up on day one, and, you know, I'll give him credit. He's a smart guy, aggressive, a real player, and he started hiring people right away, and he was right there in the middle early on in the first days. You would see Trump 6, 8, 10 times a day around the Obamacare repeal and a lot of the original strategy. In fact, it's really interesting to watch the tax fight from the perspective of me understanding that, you know, Gary Cohn in April, it was a one-page document that basically said, let's cut corporate taxes by more than 50%, and watching him, you know, create this thing. So the president in February asked Cohn and Mnuchin to put together a list of, in quotes, improvements, which included, like, let's take the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and rip it apart. Let's take away all of its power, and we're seeing that play out now. But I want to point out that the judge ruled in Mulvaney's favor on a temporary restraining order. This is hardly over.
It's not over.
Yeah, I mean, who knows if there'd be any room in the news with, you know, a Flynn in Russia and daily tweets and all. But this will keep on going on. And you know, the importance here isn't just the remaining 8 months. If the Trump administration could have their acting director running the CFPB, the Senate would be in no rush to create a permanent director. And so if it takes 2 years, well, we have Mulvaney or somebody as the acting director. There's no stopping him from naming his own replacement because he has two jobs. He's the head of the OMB at the same time. Well, meanwhile, the Senate could take a couple of years to pass to confirm, and that person from the day it's confirmed gets 5 years. That's what happened with Bridget Cordray. Instead of the only reason that whole mess happened is the Republican senators in 2011 put off confirming Cordray, Obama's choice, for like nearly 2 years. So his term ended in the middle, supposed to end in the middle of 2018 instead of in 2016, where it would have been a much cleaner thing that aligned with the presidential change. So, I mean, that's what I think is dangerous here. It might get the Senate Republicans an extra few years, an extra couple of years of running the CFPB, where there is a strong director who does have a lot of power and can do a lot to rewrite regulations so they favor business.
And David Diane reported for The Intercept this week that across government, temporary acting directors are dropping the acting and just saying that they're directors. It's a coup. It's like a bureaucratic coup d'etat. So we have both Cohn and Mnuchin, also a Goldman alum, crafting, or I guess helping to craft, because the hard work is being done on Capitol Hill, this monstrous Republican tax bill. I mean, do we have any sense of how Goldman would fare if the bill becomes law?
Yeah, they'll save about $1 billion a year in taxes. You know, it's interesting. The big fight over corporate taxes in recent years have been corporations aren't paying the 35% rate. You or I, we're paying what we have to pay on our income, but the corporations weren't. But it turns out that Goldman Sachs actually was paying, we figured out, an annual rate of about 29-30%, depending on the year. So a cut from 35% to 20% is a significant cut for a company like Goldman Sachs. $800-900 million 1 year would have been $1 billion plus another year.
That's interesting. By the way, I have a piece at The Nation called Steve Bannon and Members of Trump's Inner Circle Stash Investments in Offshore Tax Havens. It's about the Paradise Papers, if readers want to check that out. I just want to add that the Republicans are justifying passing this tax bill that will increase federal deficits by between $1 and $1.5 trillion over the next decade by claiming that, and we've all seen this before, that the magic growth fairies will use their pixie dust to pay for the package. And Steve Mnuchin has been promising an analysis from Treasury that would support those claims, right?
He said we have 100 people working on it.
100 people working on it, right? And on Thursday, it was reported that the agency's inspector general is opening an investigation into why it hasn't been released. And what
but
are
you
the
know
only
why
options?
It hasn't been released.
There's two options.
You can't prove that. You can't prove that. That's why, you know, maybe they do have 100 people and none of them could figure it out, because history, time and time again, back in 2004, the big thing was...
We've done this so many times. We've seen it again and again and again.
Yeah, you know, corporations get into money, you know, get this big, in fact, a favorite Gary Cohn moment, the raising hands moment. Gary Cohn is at a business conference, room full of CEOs, and asks, like, you know, who here is going to take that tax break and invest it in factories and creating jobs? And only a few hands went up, and he actually said out loud, like, why aren't there more hands? And, you know, you've seen articles since then. The reason there aren't more hands is because corporations are going to give it in dividends back to their shareholders. They're going to buy stock of their own. They're going to just throw it on the pile. You know, they're not going to hire because of that. I mean, they're going to hire if people had more money in their pockets, if middle-class people truly did get a tax refund, instead of it being $5 billion-plus for the top 1% in tax cuts and $5 billion-plus in tax increases for people making 40 or 50 grand. If it was reversed, people would actually start buying things and companies would hire. That's why companies hire people, because they have more business, because there are more people who want to buy things, not because you just handed them an extra $1 billion a year. What's Goldman Sachs going to do if they make $1 billion extra next year? Open, you know, hire more people, open offices, open factories. Goldman Sachs, a lot of Wall Street doesn't even do anything, right? They just play with money, give them an extra $1 billion and they cheer and give it to themselves in bonus.
It's an intermediary sector of the economy. Gary Rivlin, I believe we are out of time. I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me today. I really enjoyed our talk.
It's been a lot of fun. Thank you.
Folks, the book is called Wall Street's White House, How Gary Cohen Wrecked the Global Economy and Parlayed It into a White House Job, and I urge you to check it out. I also want to thank Luke Harding. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show at iTunes or Podbean or SoundCloud or wherever else you can find it. I would like to thank the good folks at Hullabaloo and Crooks and Liars and Smirking Chimp for letting me host the show at their prospective joints. You can write an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. And of course, I would like to thank all of you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.